It's a negative
Yeah.
Ghost Rider. Not
Yeah.
today. Oh my good gracious.
Okay.
As the conversations devolve even further.
Spiraling out of control. Yeah.
Yeah, all right. I gotta collect myself. Hold on.
Like
Ooh.
a P-38 with its tail boom blown off.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Fluttering down.
That's
Like a one-winged mosquito.
right.
All right.
Okay.
Ha.
Channel our
Serenity
inner
now.
gravitas.
Serenity now. All
Ready
right.
now.
Which one is this? 513?
What
No
the
anymore.
hell are we doing? Yeah, I
Who
don't know.
cares? All right, here
Okay.
we go. Hello. Sorry. I'm leaving this in. I'm gonna leave it in. Why not?
We can
All
do
right.
this.
Get it together. All right, here we go. Hello and welcome to episode 513 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Perrin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, renowned author, good dude, great buddy, John Parshall. How are you, John?
I'm very well, thank you. Obviously, a little bit, a little bit. I don't know what I am. I'm teetering on the brink of hilarity. So there we
There we
are.
go. There we
Yep.
go. And with us again this week to continue the conversation, which I thought was absolutely fascinating last week, is our mutual good friend, fantastic historian Rich Frank. How are you this fine day, Rich?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad to be here, slumming it with you all.
Nice.
And the hits keep coming.
You keep coming.
Back. You're back.
All right. Oh, geez, Louise. All right. So, if you remember from last week, I'm not going to give my normal pithy, long-winded introduction. If you recall from at last week's episode, we left off in July, just right about the beginning of July 1941. And that's exactly where we're going to pick up this week. And, Rich, I'm going to throw the ball to you because, of course, we know what happens in July 41. This is the oil embargo that's put on Japan by the United States. But there's a lot of steps that go to this event and a lot of things that happen. So, Rich, take it. What's going on July 41? How do we get to the oil embargo?
Well, let me start at really what I think is the most basic and fundamental key to understanding exactly what happened with respect to U.S. policy, which means you have to understand what FDR is thinking. And FDR, as I mentioned in the last episode, he has this exchange with the American ambassador in Tokyo, who asks him, for guidance. And FDR says, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, he says, "We must remember that events in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia are all part of a single global conflict." In other words, it's all connected. And that really is the key to understanding FDR's outlook, and indeed the key to, in my view, to understanding exactly what's going to happen in this very complicated 6 months from the middle of 1941 to the Pearl Harbor Day that gets us into World War II. Now, stepping back just briefly, as late as the 18th of June, FDR, in conversations with members of his cabinet, says that he's still adamantly opposed to imposing any oil embargo on Japan. And up to this point, which effectively has been 4 years since July of 37, his view has been that if the US would impose an oil embargo on Japan, the most likely Japanese move is to swoop down to the Dutch East Indies and seize their oil there. And FDR sees no prospect that the American public will support a war with Japan over saving a colony.
Dutch oil.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. So that's sort of the background. And then on the 22nd of June, just 4 days later, Hitler attacks the Soviet Union. And this is where we get into the period when things are going to happen fast and things are going to change. I was fascinated when I was going through this with the question of what did Washington and London know about what's going on what quickly became called the Eastern Front? Well, the answer is that neither one of them had any direct observers on site, on the ground there, whatever. In fact, there were certainly no unauthorized observers floating around on either side or whatever here. And as I looked around a little bit more, I suddenly realized that based on even what you could find in the US archives, was guiding me back to the fact that the New York Times, every day on page two, was printing a map of what was going on in the Soviet Union based on the communiques issued by Berlin and Tokyo. Now, those communiques did not agree on very much.
Sure.
Especially initially, the Germans, of course, were reporting they were driving forward on all fronts expeditiously. The Soviets were insisting that they were holding the Germans off and were keeping them at bay. Actually, what was going on was that Germans were driving strongly in the north and the center. They were encountering serious resistance, at least at first, in the south, over here.
Yep.
But over time, the Soviets had to admit where the fighting was taking place. And there you can see what's happening is the Germans are driving very deeply into the Soviet Union. And what then struck me as extremely significant was when you get to the last 10 days of July, suddenly those maps and the communiques basically show the front has stabilized. That
right.
for a period of time, it looks like the Soviets are holding out and implying that maybe they'll hold out for more than just a few days, that maybe this is the big turning point, that they will stay in the war. Well, from FDR's perspective and that of most of his government, the fact, the possibility that Soviet Union will stay in the war against Germany, you almost can't put a size classification on it. I mean, it's so huge.
Yeah, it's enormous.
It powers over everything else. So the question is, what at that point should the U.S. do? Well, concurrently with that, with the attack, FDR has at least agreed to commence an oil embargo against Japan. However, initially, he's quite clear it's going to be a flexible tool, as he describes it to one of his cabinet members, you know, like a noose I can tighten or loosen as circumstances dictate, but clearly indicating he's not thinking about, at that point, a total embargo. And we have further evidence, which is important, because there's a sort of conspiracy theory notion that whatever FDR intended, a member of his administration, specifically the Natchison, converts what FDR was intended to be a flexible tool into an absolute embargo.
Right.
Waldo Hendricks found a clear memo from Sumner Wells, who effectively was the U.S. Secretary of State at that time. That wasn't official title, but that's what he was performing as. And he instructs Acheson that basically he's simply to do nothing about releasing oil to Japan for a period of time, which is going to cover this Atlantic Charter Conference or whatever. Here. So at that to that point, it's not clear that the oil embargo is going to be permanent. So the FDR has arranged for a meeting with Winston Churchill, which is going to become called the Atlantic Conference. And with Churchill comes FDR's key aide, Harry Hopkins. And Hopkins has been to Moscow at FDR's direction. He had been in London, and FDR ordered him to continue on to Moscow. And there he gets a special face-to-face conference with Stalin.
Yeah.
And at the conference, the short story is Stalin convinced him that the Soviet Union is going to fight on. And it's interesting that the key piece of evidence that Hopkins will emphasize later to FDR is that when Hopkins asks him, what do they immediately need? And Stalin says, anti-aircraft guns and aluminum. Well, the implication with aluminum is we're going to be around for a while because you can't convert aluminum to an airplane without a special period of time. So that's what he said.
Well, and it's on the face of it, some people may look at that and aluminum. What do you need aluminum for? And you're right; it's crucially important for aircraft. But the other thing is that every Soviet tank had an aluminum engine block. So, yeah, without aluminum, you ain't making no T-34s. And just to sort of fast forward, we will eventually be supplying the Soviet Union with about half of their aluminum. That's going to be one of the key components of Lend-Lease when that actually gets up and running. The other thing that I think is so fascinating about this meeting with Stalin is that this is one of the few occasions when the Soviet upper leadership actually opens up and is at least somewhat candid with an American representative. And this is not going to be the case, you know, except very occasionally throughout the remainder of the war. I mean, we always think of the Soviets as being our allies, but in truth, if you look at the amount of candor in that relationship was extremely low. We never had any idea of, you know, what operations were up and coming by the Red Army or any of that stuff. I mean, if you contrast that with the the incredible amount of transparency there was between the British and the Americans and their joint command staff, which is just a model of how to run an actual joint war. You know, the relationship with the Soviets is it's completely not that. So, yeah, so the fact that Stalin actually opens up to Hopkins in the way that he does, I think, is incredibly important in this respect.
It's also a
Exactly.
reflection on the way the war had been going to that point, stabilizing the front or not. They'd taken a beating. And I mean, he
It's the largest military catastrophe in recorded human history, just hands down. You know, by the time that you get to the end of this year, the Red Army has lost 4 million soldiers or something like that. It's just the mind boggles. So the fact that they're still in the field in any capacity whatsoever is nothing short of miraculous. Anyway.
But yeah, that goes to the point of him being candid. He's like, hey, we need everything we can get right now, brother. Just, fork it over, if you will.
Anyway.
The other important point that goes on during that meeting with Hopkins in Moscow is the Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov tells him that the Soviets want the U.S. to make a public declaration that if Japan attacks the Soviet Union, the U.S. will come into the war against Japan. Hopkins has to beg off. That's not how we do it in the good old
That
USSR.
ain't gonna happen.
But he comes away from that and he brings those two messages to FDR at the Atlantic Conference. Now, from Churchill's standpoint, what the British are hoping for is this is going to lead to the U.S. a declaration of war against Germany. Of course, that's not going to happen. Whatever here. But what we have following the Atlantic Conference is the oil embargo becomes a permanent, which is a font of all kinds of controversy about exactly what happened. And my view is that if you put simple logical parameters on this, it's clear that if the Soviets are going to survive, it's absolutely huge. It's even huger than the prospect of war with Japan. That's where FDR sees it. And he's brought that message from, Hopkins has brought that message from the Soviets, effectively see things the same way. Now, I communicate with David Glantz on this. And David Glantz says, okay, well, even if the Japanese did come in, the Soviet playbook would be like a rerun of 1919, 1920, which is basically they concede in the Far East and concentrate on the Western Front, settle things there, and then turn around and recoup whatever they lost. And that may very well be true. But that's not what the insight that was blessed to the US and the UK at that time. They're thinking that it's really critical that the Soviets hold out. Now, the other thing about explaining what the rationale is that FDR, of course, is famously, the left, as he put it, his left hand never knows what his right hand is doing. And if you've been a historian who's tried to track FDR's thinking and what he shares, I've talked to a lot of really good FDR historians who say that who knows at times he leaves everything up in the air to the last
He was
minute,
opaque,
you opaque.
absolutely opaque.
The clearest piece of evidence I found on exactly what's going on, interestingly enough, comes actually from Churchill. In November, his foreign minister, Anthony Eden, asked him for guidance on US-Japan relations at that point. And FDR makes the obvious point, well, the US obviously has the lead, it will be basically following the US lead to the degree that Churchill would be willing to contemplate some loosening of terms or whatever. He says, well, we might think about that. He says, but under no circumstances must we abandon China or permit the Soviet Union to attack, permit Japan to attack the Soviet Union. And to me, that is it's glaringly obvious as to what FDR is thinking at the same time there. So that's exactly what we have. Those maps, by the way, in the New York Times continue to be the basic source of information in Washington and London about what's going on, with one caveat. The British are breaking certain Soviet codes, most notably the air liaison officers, who, of course, get situational reports from the Wehrmacht about what's going on. Gives them better insight into what the situation is on the ground. And the British, in another sort of subtext of all this, also pick up significant messages that are showing the Germans have switched to this massive extermination campaign against the Jews or whatever, although that becomes lost for a long time. But that's where we are. And that's why I think to understand that, you have to understand that now FDR sees a global war, understands where Japan and the Soviet Union and Germany all fit into it. And he sees that keeping the Soviets in the war is by far the most important objective.
Yeah, I was just going to say that with respect to the Soviet situation at this point, it's really difficult to gauge just how close they were to collapse or not collapse. One of the points that I make, certainly with respect to 1942, is that even in the middle of 42, the wheels could have come off the Soviet economy. And that there's, I think, a tendency in the sort of the Eastern Front community to overfocus on the military aspects of that conflict and underfocus on the domestic and economic aspects of that conflict. And that at the end of the day, if the Soviet people stop believing in victory and just decide, I'm not going to the factory today, I got to focus on finding some potatoes. This war is over, you know. If and this is exactly what had happened during World War I. In the cities, the worker, you know, the farmers decided, ah, I'm not getting enough, you know, money for my crops. I'm not going to sell to the city workers anymore. The city workers go on strike. The Tsarist Republic goes into the toilet, and everything falls apart. Stalin understands this. This is one of the reasons that Stalin collectivized agriculture in the Soviet Union, was to make sure that the farmers did not have the leverage in this situation anymore that the state does. Because, you know, Stalin certainly understands how states fall apart. No one understands that better than he. He helped, you know, make the Tsarist state fall apart. Anyway,
Right.
all this to say that if the Japanese had decided to attack the Soviets in Manchuria, and as we mentioned last week, there was an incident where the Kwantung Army moved 700,000 troops up to the border. This is
Right.
the last thing the Soviets need at the end of 1941, because talk about bleak. Things are really, really bleak in the USSR at this point.
Yeah, and to follow along with that, there is that period early on in the German attack on the Soviet Union, like in the Ukraine, which had suffered tremendously during the tariff
Yes.
famines or whatever here, where the Germans are initially received in many quarters as liberators, you know,
Yes. Right.
until they get a full taste of
Lithuania, especially.
what the Germans actually have, you know,
In
in
store for
store
them.
for them, whatever. I
Yeah.
mean, it's a very interesting historical question. Had Hitler been more deceptive in that initial invasion about what his objectives were, you know, would the
Right.
Soviet Union survive? Thankfully, we don't have to go back and, you know,
Yeah.
see exactly how that would have played out. But yeah,
Yeah.
it's,
So
you know, this initial phrase here, whatever here, and I think it's very important, as John says. You have to understand that the Soviet Union's survival is by no means a guaranteed deal in
that
41,
is right.
well into 42. You
Right.
know, and American leaders are very, very conscious of that.
So let's look at the embargo itself. So it's convoluted. It's not just you don't have any more oil, and that's all they're, you know, you're not getting any more. There's a whole series of steps that go in between there, though, in terms
Right.
of, you know, we freeze the Japanese assets, and then we have to make them, or they have to essentially fill out a permit for everything they want, and it has to be approved and paid for, but they can't pay for it because we got, you know, froze their assets. Can you break that down into
Yeah,
layman's terms for us?
that the way things had been set up by 1941 was there were two steps for the Japanese to actually receive U.S. oil. The first was they had to have a permit for X amount of oil to receive. That has to be approved. Then they had to give payment. Now they kept funds in the U.S. To pay for the
For
oil.
that, yeah.
So you need a permit, and then you needed the funds. So that two-step process meant that if either one of those is cut off, no
Right.
oil for anybody or whatever here. So that's what had happened, is that the Japanese had a number of permits which were still pending at the time that we imposed the total embargo, and we just simply said, we're not going to honor your
Right.
funding, and therefore the permits are no good. That's how that whole permit system worked. So once the Japanese fully realized that, oh my God, this is in fact a
This is
total
real.
embargo on
Yeah.
oil, you know, and again, they were getting, I have it at like 75 or 80% of their petroleum was
80%,
coming
yeah.
from the US. I've seen people giving figures as high as 90%. I mean, 75% is more than enough to do the job, you
Yeah,
know,
sure. Right.
making their life, you know, unbearable. So, you know, it is catastrophic when they lose the access to the oil. And again, this is a risk. I mean, FDR understands the risk that's involved here very well. And the only thing that could lead him to do this is because he sees a larger strategic issue,
Right.
which is survival of the Soviet Union. Seems to me.
Right.
And I think we've had a big problem with the historiography here because it's been a stovepipe. It's the U.S. and Japan not seeing it
Right.
in a global context to understand
Right.
exactly what FDR is thinking. And of course, seeing it in a global context is exactly what FDR does, above all else.
So the Japanese reaction to this, I mean, they knew that that threat was out there for the embargo. I mean, it was not a veiled threat at all. They knew that it was potentially coming. When it finally comes, it hits them like a two by
Stunning.
four in the face.
Yeah,
What
really,
is
really.
their, yeah, what's their governmental reaction? Is it just, it's hair on fire? It's like, oh my God.
Well, let me preface that by saying now, as you go down through July to December 1941, it's like we're on a long downhill slalom.
Right.
There's
Yeah.
all kinds of things happening, and we're going to try to compress a lot of this down
Sure.
to the most basic points. Well, the first thing that happens is Kanoi, the Japanese prime minister, he's flabbergasted. I mean, he's stunned. He doesn't think this is going to come to pass. His reaction to it, however, is that he looks around and he proposes to have a face-to-face, in effect, what we call a summit meeting with FDR. And that's the first proposal that he makes, or whatever. From the US side, there's some rather major problems with that. Number one is Kanoi is not exactly have the reputation as a peacemaker. I mean, he's the
Right.
guy who's been leading Japan into war with Japan now for years. The second thing is, this is the era of Munich, you know, allied nations sitting down with Axis nations at meetings, you know, does not have happy connotations anywhere. So the US position is, okay, we might do the meeting, but the meeting is only for the purpose of formally adopting an agreement which has already been reached prior to the summit meeting. So that's the US position, which I think is quite reasonable at that point. Kanoi's problem is that he knows, basically, that there's absolutely no way. I'm sorry, I had to, there's a deer running across my.
As they do.
So I wasn't bored with Seth or John. I was just looking at the deer. So the problem is that, you know, Kanoi has no ability to get anything like acceptable terms for the US out
Right.
of the Japanese military at this time. So his vision is that, okay, agree to the meeting and then we'll settle things face to face at the meeting or whatever here. And part of the problem of the Japanese sell on this is that they use as one of their arguments for it. Well, the Japanese militarists are so powerful that, you know, that they could block an agreement if we sit around here and twiddle our thumbs before we go to this meeting. But of course, the problem is when you read that backwards, it says that even after the meeting, they may block the agreement. So on the US
Right.
side, you know, it's just insistent, one insistent after another. You know, we've got to have some terms settled before we have the meeting. And of course,
Right.
this is never going to happen. And meanwhile, we get this.
I was just going to say, interesting shades of, you know, fast forward 4 years. This is going to be the same thing that we're going to be trying to deal with in terms of trying to end the war. You know, that the Japanese government can't agree amongst themselves what the terms are going to be. And everybody understands that the military, particularly the army, at the end of the day holds this, you know, trump card of we'll coup you and kill you if we don't like what we're getting in terms of terms. So,
Get
yeah, it's a mess.
some sense of the problem. And the Imperial Army has circulating among their quarters, there's a saying describing Kanoi, or dealing with Kanoi is like, quote, nailing jelly to the wall, unquote.
That's beautiful.
So you can see that there's not a trust is in short supply when it comes to dealing with
Yeah.
it. And of course, at the end of the day, Kanoi's going to have to go.
The other thing that's happening here is that as soon as the embargo comes down, yes, it's like a two by four to the face because the Japanese considered that as long as their mechanism for grabbing more territory was, quote, peaceful, unquote, that nobody was gonna quibble about it. And so to get this slap in the face is a real eye-opener for them. And it's at this point that the Navy steps in and becomes the primary driver towards war. Because up until this point, of course, the Kwantung Army has been saying, strike north, you know, the Soviets are our enemies. But oil just clarifies the situation as far as the Japanese Navy is concerned. And they now basically tell the Army, look, dudes, we're not going to have enough oil to operate this Navy for more than 2 years once the spigots are turned off. And given the amount of treasure, national treasure, that we have poured into this fleet in the intervening years here, we cannot now turn around and tell the Japanese people that we're not going to, you know, defend what we feel is ours, and that all of that treasure that you guys, you know, put on the national register during the Depression is now moot. So it is the Navy that reorients strategy and says very clearly, the oil, we have to have oil. The oil that we need is in the Netherlands, East Indies. That's where we have to go. It has to be strike south at this point. And the Army, for its part, can't disagree with the Navy's logic. And furthermore, they understand too that if they initiate a war and they are successful in capturing Burma, that that potentially then cuts the Burma Road, which is the last remaining road link from the Western Allies to Shang, which hopefully then ends up solving the China War all in one swell swoop. So you see then this rapid reorientation of Japanese military strategy towards striking south. And this helps disprove one of the primary myths that I grew up with when I was a kid reading about this. It was always, oh, the Japanese have been planning this campaign against the Allies for years and years, and they had de baloney. This was a completely pickup affair from a military planning standpoint, and we'll get to that in one of our future episodes. But yeah, this is a real surprise for the Japanese. They're like, oh, what would it take to commence a war aimed south? Better figure that out in the next 3 months.
And that's pretty much what they do, because let's set the timetable for now. We're September 1941, and that's when these plans are
Well, we're
starting
in
to,
July, but
well, we're moving forward to September now.
I mean,
So
a lot of these plans are not going to be formally ratified until, end of October.
right, but the talks begin to, in serious,
Talks,
yeah, it's starting now. So we're looking at what do they call it? The essentials for carrying out the empire's policies is what the Japanese
I
termed it. And
always
it's a,
love their incredibly vaguely worded directives. Like, it's just whatever.
right.
Yeah, anyway. Well,
And
given the
it,
internal dissension between the Imperial Army and Imperial Navy being vague and is an essential to all agreements, I just insert one brief note. What puts another major part of the kibosh on the Imperial Army's plans is that by the, I think it's the 9th of August, they figured the Germans are not necessarily going to get all the way to Moscow or knock right.
the Soviets out of the war at that point, which reinforces the fact that, you know, the Navy says that, you know, we can't do both. And
Right.
especially, and we can't do one going to the Soviet Union when we don't have any oil. So, you know, no two ways about it. Now, you get to this this meeting in September. It's preceded by a rather notable meeting when Emperor Hirohito sits down, one of the few moments when he has some clear clarity of his vision that he inflicts upon the armed forces. That's on September 5th. And so he's read the draft of this thing that they're going to do the next day. And the draft, in Hirohito's view, clearly emphasizes war over diplomacy, right? Which is totally against what Hirohito believes ought to be their stance. So he's
Right.
conducting an interrogation. First, of he has Kanoye in, and Kanoye simply denies that they're going to put the war ahead of diplomacy. Then he has the two chiefs of staff in. He has the chief of the Nagano and
Nagano.
Sugiyama. And so he has an even better session with them. You know, he asks Sugiyama, you know, how long would a war with the U.S. last? And Sugiyama gives him, what, I figure, what, like 1 or 3 months or something like that. And Hirohito's retort is, well, you told me China would last 1 month, and here we are 4 years down the pike. And Sugiyama's brilliant reply is, well, China is big. And Hirohito says, well, isn't the Pacific Ocean a lot bigger? This is one of the few razor sharp clarification moments that we're going to get from Hirohito. So then Nagano tries to pick up the pieces of the bloody remains of Sugiyama, which apparently is laying on the floor in front of the emperor at this point. And Sugiyama compares it to a doctor offering a patient an operation to save his life. It's not a very good analogy, but for whatever reason is that Hirohito comes away with the notion that they've agreed that they have to emphasize diplomacy over war initially. So they go on to the next day about these fundamentals or whatever here.
Right.
Really, to really frame this up, once again, what you have to understand is what are the Japanese, what's their main issue here? Their main issue at this point is, first of all, in the background is ending the war in China. I mean, that's the big thing. That limits them from doing anything else or whatever here at that point. And of course, the oil embargo means that they've got to figure out how they're going to deal with a lack of oil, which pretty much puts the kibosh in there. And they can obviously see that the oil embargo obviously has tremendous implications of don't go north,
Yeah.
So, that's where they are.
Yeah. So we touched on it briefly just a few minutes ago, but let's talk about it now. And we talked about it via email last week, but looking at the status as it is in September 1941, we're gonna have, we being the Japanese, we're gonna have to move south. We're gonna have to take these oil fields and resources that are now being cut off from us. And more than likely, this is going to result in a war with the United States and Great Britain. And we kind of talked about it briefly. We skirted around it, but there are several officials, high officials in the Japanese government and military that say one thing in one conversation and say another thing in another conversation, and they're completely bass-ackwards. They don't jive. And the Navy in particular, the IJN in particular, has very little faith and their ability to defeat the United States in a prolonged war. We know this. We've heard about this, but this is a fascinating discussion that these guys are essentially, they're going to walk their way into a war that they know in September 1941 they cannot win. And it's
What's it? I was
go
going to say,
ahead.
what you're looking at is one of the most startling examples of lack of moral courage you're going to see in all of statecraft of World War
So I
II.
was going to say, yeah.
And exactly as you said, Seth, when they're by themselves and the admirals were together, they know that
Yeah.
taking on the U.S.
Ain't gonna happen.
in any prolonged war is not a recipe for victory for Japan. They know
Right.
that,
Right.
very
Yeah,
clearly.
there's.
And they say it to each other, right?
Right.
But when it comes to the major councils, where they're supposed to stand up and forthrightly declare the position of the Imperial Navy,
Right.
oh no, oh no.
Yeah.
We can go out
Fukotome.
for a certain period of time and establish a formidable defensive perimeter, and who knows what will happen, whatever here, and all this sort of verbiage that they will spin out through this period. But it's the shocking lack of moral courage by these
Right.
guys. And
Right. It
they'd rather than embarrass themselves in front of the Imperial Army, they're basically prepared to let the country, go down in flames.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's this series of imperial liaison conferences that are happening throughout this time period, and basically any number of higher uppity ups in those meetings knew that someone had to stand up and fall on their sword and say, "This is crazy." But everyone else is looking around for somebody else to be the one who's going to fall on their sword, and the result is that the can just keeps getting kicked down the road, and you enter into this sort of sense of automaticity around these sort of happenings, because often the results of these meetings would be, well, if diplomacy fails by date X, then automatically we're going to have to go to war. And again, there were opportunities here for humans to intervene and say, hello, this is not a good idea. There's a quote from Admiral Nagano speaking of, some of the stuff that Fukutome says, which is pretty vague as to how do you actually plan to end this war? And statement that he makes to the emperor around this time is that what would happen after a successful campaign would, quote, depend to a great extent on overall national power, including various elements, tangible and intangible, and on developments in the world situation, which I call a mouthful of nothingness, if ever
Yeah,
there
what the
was
hell is
one.
that supposed to mean?
Yeah.
I would call bingo at this point. That's exactly that was the quote I was thinking of, as a matter of fact. That's
Okay.
exactly,
Is
yeah,
that
the sort
it?
of mumbo jumbo that
Yeah.
they pronounce rather than, you know. And then the other classic moment is that, you know, Okagwa, you know, says, you know, that basically when he's confronted
By Tojo.
by Tojo, he says, you know, he tells Tojo, we have no confidence in the war. But ultimately, the decision as to whether to go to war or not is a political decision, not one for the Imperial Army, the Imperial Navy to make or whatever. When you read this, and you're just, it comes back to the point I mentioned before. I mean, it is the most, and this is going to continue in 1945, as John touched upon. It's the most dysfunctional, higher level strategic policymaking apparatus and structure of any of the major combatants of World War II. You know, I've talked to
It's
historians,
a
students,
cluster.
whatever, trying to make them understand that this was actually the reality of the
Yeah.
Japanese policymaking, decision making. It's like they, you know, it's beyond comprehension.
So just to give an idea to the audience, to the listeners, watchers, whatever, of the confidence, and I'm using air quotes here, that the Japanese naval officials had in a prolonged war with the United States, Fukudome, who, if you go back and you listen, we've talked about him several times. He predicted that by 1943, Japan would not have any merchant ships with which to supply their own country with food and or whatever material resources they were to capture by 1943. Of course, we know they do, but they're not that far off. He's not that far off. And on top of that, the quote that you were referring to, Rich, Oikawa, who was the Navy minister, tells Tojo, when Tojo asks him, Tojo specifically says to Oikawa, what do you think the Navy's chances are if we go to war? He says, and I, or he says, do you think you have confidence in victory over the United States in a protracted naval war? And Oikawa tells Tojo, quote, that I do not have. If war continues for a few years, we do not know what the outcome will be, unquote. So in other words, he's saying, no.
And that's it's the word protracted. That is the razor that bisects everything here. That it's understood by the Japanese Navy, at least, that this, and I've said this on numerous occasions, the Japanese are fighting a deliberately short-sighted war
Sure.
because people like Yamamoto and Oikawa understand that if we cannot get this war over with in 6 months to a year, we're in deep weeds. And so everything from a military planning standpoint, and again, we'll touch on that later, is oriented for a campaign that is maximally front loaded. You know, we're gonna hit the Allies like a ton of bricks at the beginning of this thing and hope to crack their morale, because if they don't drop out of the war and we can't get them to the negotiating table within a year, we're toast. And yeah, I don't know what to do. You know, that's
And
really
that's
what it
why
comes
they
to.
chase that decisive unicorn for the entire war.
Absolutely, from the outset.
So another sticking point for the US at this point too, and we talked about the oil embargo's effects on Japan, but you know, part of the reason that the damn oil embargo is there in the first place is we want Japan out of China. And that is a point for the Japanese. They're like, that's not happening. We've,
No.
you know, Tojo says it would essentially lose face for the 200,000 souls that have been lost in China.
Yeah.
To and you know, I
Which
mean,
is a
I kind of get it, but it's also,
Yeah,
it's
but
like
that
that's a
is
sticking point, you know.
well, and this is a classic sunk cost fallacy, right? They always teach you in business school about sunk costs. Those sunk costs are gone. You can't do anything to
Right.
recoverment at this point. And getting hung up on, you know,
Saving
the
face, essentially.
saving face, that's not going to lead you out of the conundrum that you've gotten yourselves into. So,
Quagmire,
anyway. Now, the other thing that's in the background here, though, it's hard to tease out of the available evidence a clear indication of this. But if you look at the big picture, I mean, the Japanese, excuse me, were convinced, at least up to the latter part of 1940, that they'd signed up on the winning side. You know, and they had good reason to believe that somehow, you know, they basically subcontracted the survival of the Japanese Empire to Nazi Germany, you know, because they were counting on the Germans doing the heavy lifting, knocking out the Soviet Union, turning and knocking out the UK, at which point they thought the US would be deterred from entering the war. So this is in the background, I don't remember, I cannot recall seeing a clear statement by any of the principals
really articulating that clearly, although we know that was definitely part of the mindset.
And that still looks like a fairly safe bet, even in September and October of 1941. Yes, there's a lull in the combat as the Germans are regrouping their forces. They're moving three of their four armored groups to the north to eventually kick off what is going to be Operation Typhoon, which is going to be aimed at capturing Moscow. And you have to think that the Japanese are getting at least some wind of those plans because, of course, they have military liaisons in Berlin. So, yeah, from the Japanese standpoint, okay, we didn't get a win in the Soviet Union by the Germans within the first 6 weeks, like a lot of people had anticipated. But it's the Germans are certainly still looking pretty strong for being able to capture Moscow at the end of this year, which would be an enormous blow to the Soviet regime. So anyway.
On the U.S. side, what happens at this point is that sometime in September, the main diplomats have been evacuated from Moscow.
Right.
And for a while, there's a lot of pessimistic stuff coming out of the U.S. Embassy and in the alternate capital at that time about whether the Soviets are going to hold out or not. Then they get into October, and for a while, even the New York Times is writing that it looks like the Soviets are going to hold out. And then the ground freezes.
Right.
And the next thing that happens is these
The
two
Panzers
Panzer
get on
arms
the loose.
are closing in around Moscow or
Yep.
whatever. And
And you had
once
these.
again, American perceptions of what's going on, go down to a pretty low point about
For sure.
whether the Soviets are going to hold out or not,
Because there are some
So,
enormous battles that happen at places like
yes.
Vyazma, which, end up capturing or
Yes.
killing another million Soviet soldiers. They're
Exactly.
catastrophes.
Exactly. So the whole,
So,
I was going to say, the contingency of this is just, endless.
Exactly. So speaking of diplomats, I was going to ask, when does Nomura get sent to DC?
Oh, Nomura,
And we should preface that by saying, so
I know
Nomura.
it's relatively early in 41.
Oh, really? Okay. So he's already there.
Because he's been there a long time. He's been there through the Atlantic Conference and everything.
Okay.
And then when the regime changes and you get to Tojo becomes prime minister, he sends Kurusu as sort of his
Caruso.
backup,
Back up, yeah.
which the foreign minister Togo thinks is necessary because he has no confidence in Nomura.
Right.
And the two of them together, which brings us to an important point. Kurusu and Nomura, they understand perfectly well what's going on. Now, they're not privy to the ultimate plans of the Japanese high command, is what they're going
Right,
to
and
do.
that's we should preface that. Can you give me some quick biographical sketches of these two cats, Nomura and Kurusu, just for our audience?
Nomura is a former fleet admiral
Yep.
in the Imperial Navy. He speaks some, although not very good, English or whatever here. He is very popular with the Americans, who see him as a moderate and someone they can talk to and deal with.
Right.
Kurusu is a professional diplomat. He's a very natty dresser. He is a very smart guy. He's very well spoken. He has very clear visions of exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
He has the unfortunate part of his resume is that when the Japanese and the Soviets and Germans signed the Tripartite Pact, he's present as representing Japan, which is
Right.
not his view is what should go on, but he's sort of tarred by that.
Yeah, that's not
He's
going to be
a,
a ticket for entree as far as FDR is concerned.
no, exactly.
And
And
the exact date of the switchover from the Konoe to Tojo government.
the 17th of October.
October
Kinoe
16th.
resigns on the 16th
Okay.
when he morally he reveals really at the end of the day he's a moral sufferer. He's led the country into this absolutely catastrophic situation, and the
Yeah.
first thing he does is hit the ejection button. Even after Kito has told him, you can't leave now. You've led us down to this point.
Right. You got us here.
That's in September. Then on the 16th of October, he bails. Then the day after that, they find out that one of his chief aides is a Soviet agent.
I didn't
So
know that. Okay.
that doesn't exactly highly recommend him to the Japanese at that point. So
Right.
Tojo comes in on the 17th. Importantly, he appoints Togo as the foreign minister, who is a very clear-eyed guy. Well, interestingly enough, is Korean. This is one of the really bizarre things. If you understand the dynamics of Imperial Japan, whatever, it's hard enough to be a totally certified prime Japanese in the leadership, right? To bring in a guy who's literally Korean. His family were paupers who were kidnapped and brought to Japan literally hundreds of years before. They maintained the purity of their bloodline to that point.
Yeah.
But in effect, he is, Togo in many ways is more Japanese than that's how he gets where he is. He's more Japanese than the loyalist Japanese, you know, and he's a very shrewd guy, whatever.
Yeah.
So he knows what's going on. But this, get back to where we were. So Nomura and Caruso, you know, are given this pretty impossible task, you know, because the bottom line throughout this whole thing is Japan wants, there's only two outcomes Japan will accept. The first of which is the U.S. will deliver China on a silver platter to a negotiating table, then abandon China, and China will have to sign whatever the Japanese dictate, or B,
yep.
U.S. will abandon all support, moral, military, financial, diplomatic, for China, under the assumption on the Japanese side that, well, then China will have to collapse.
Right.
And not accept whatever we are. Those are the two basic principles the Japanese are pursuing through this whole period. They may articulate a little differently, but that's basically what's going on through this whole period. So Caruso, excuse me. So Caruso and Nomura, seeing how this is, you know, careening towards war, and like I said, even though they don't know the specific plans, I mean, they can read what's going on clearly.
Sure.
So they sit down, and they've been given instructions. Caruso had been given instructions before he left by Togo. And the more, shall we say, generous version of these two proposals of A and B is B.
Right.
And there was an alternative version that Togo had signed off on in giving it to Caruso that said basically they look to a status quo ante. Basically, this would be an agreement that the U.S., that Japan would withdraw from Indochina, and the U.S. would resume the oil spigot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Caruso and Nomura tried to present as the Japanese position to the U.S. government on the 17th of November. Of course, when they report what they have done, you know, there's sort of this volcanic eruption in Tokyo by Togo,
yeah.
who immediately denounces what they've done and demands that they go back, withdraw what they had submitted, and submit the most rigorous version of this proposal B, which again is this, you know, totally unacceptable proposal from the U.S. from the U.S.
perspective. Well, and I was just going to say that from a diplomatic standpoint, you know, I think the U.S. would have taken that deal. I mean, we didn't want a war at this point in time. You know, if we can get the Japanese to pull out of Indochina, I absolutely think we would have bid at that and turned the spigots back on. Because again, yeah, as you say, it restores the status quo ante. There's an active war going on in China, but the Chinese are still supplied via the Burma Road. And we have removed the potential springboard for further advances south by the Japanese towards the British or the Dutch. I think they would have gone for it. Seth, I saw you sort of shaking your head.
Well, I did, and then I thought about it but you're right, because the thing that really trips that trigger for the embargoes in the first place is the move into Indochina. Because
exactly.
As we said last week, FDR now, he looks at this, he's like, okay, this is no longer an isolated Japanese-Chinese incident. Per se, this is a war. This is an international event that now we have these people now invading not only China, they're invading another portion that ain't Chinese, and it's obvious why they're doing it. Yeah, I mean, we know to cut off the supplies, but it's also to move south further. Everybody knows that. A blind man can see that. FDR saw that, and that's why he did the first Avgas embargo in 1940, and then blammo, here comes the oil embargo in 1941, and it's all because of Indochina. So maybe, you know, I could see that to a point, but I mean, any kind of Japanese demands that the United States give up on China,
that's not going to happen.
That's a non-starter.
You know, that's just and that's a sticking point with them throughout the whole thing, is that we don't want the U.S. involved in China, quit sending aid, da 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 da, all this other stuff. And that's just not going to happen. I don't see FDR being like, okay, you know, no.
The other factor that reinforces John's point is that it's right about at this time that Marshall and Stark are telling FDR that we need to buy time until April of 42, because for whatever reason they're calculating it, that's when we'll have a position of strength in the Far East. We can deter Japan by ourselves.
Right.
So FDR is aware that he has to try to buy some time. And so that's why initially that exactly what you're saying is that proposal may very well have won favor with FDR.
Yeah, because what's going on behind the scenes at this point is that we are pumping B-17s into the Philippines for all that we're worth. And to an extent, we're sort of playing the same card that the British were playing in Malaya, in that we're hoping that air power is going to be our trump card that will somehow buoy up our extremely weak ground forces that are in both of those theaters. And MacArthur, for his part, is sending back this string of cheery reports, you know, the Philippine army is coming up to strength and we're going to be able to hold this place and raw team. And so there's this kind of happy delusional cycle that's happening here between MacArthur and, I hate to say it, Marshall, that Marshall is believing the press releases and he's like, okay, well, hell, let's keep pumping more aircraft in here and this will all be good. So that is sort of the basis for this April 1942 imaginary time frame that we'll have sufficient air power in the Philippines at this point that we should be able to hold out there.
And we're doing other developments and reinforcements of the Philippines. It'll build up strength.
Right.
Yeah, I think that as much as in so many ways George Marshall was exemplary as a
Yep.
chief of staff, this is a moment when he and Stimson and FDR all do not look very clear-sighted
Yeah.
about these events. They bought in that the B-17 Kool-Aid, you might
Right.
call it,
Yeah.
and that if we just and when you look at the tiny numbers. I mean, based on what happens later in the war, 35 B-17s is going to
Yeah, it's not
somehow
going to get it done.
deter a
No.
foreign nation from attacking. And then
Yeah.
they're talking about, along this line, of course, Marshall does this quote press briefing, supposedly confidential, but it's done deliberately with the intention to be leaked immediately, right? And he talks about how, if we get into war with Japan, we'll be utterly ruthless, threatening bomb Japanese cities, blah, 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 blah. That's all part of this by time.
Yep. Anyway.
So as things are deteriorating through the month of November, you know, we talked about some of the negotiations to a degree. FDR is not in the dark. Like, he is aware of things that are going down. He's reading the magic intercepts. He understands, he reads proposals A and B before the Japanese ever send them, number one. Number two, he says to on November the 9th, he says to Canadian Prime Minister William King that war with Japan on November, I'm sorry, November the 5th, he says to William King that war with Japan was almost certain within 30 days. This is on November 5th, 1941. Franklin Roosevelt saying this to Canadian Prime Minister. On the 9th of November, just a few days later, he tells a British Undersecretary for Air that his policy of stalling Japan may hold up for a few months or could blow up in the very near future. And again, he's reading all these diplomatic transmissions back and forth. Hell, he's reading them before the Japanese are getting them, before Nomura and Caruso are getting them in DC. So he's keenly aware of what the hell is going on. One guy we have not talked about it that we need to talk about is Joseph Grew. He is our ambassador in Japan, and he's hearing all these rumblings back and forth, and he's starting to send wires back to the US saying, hey dudes, you know, this they're I think they're a little bit closer to doing something really rash. Then you, and of course, he has no idea what it would be. But he says, and I quote, on the 3rd of November, he says, Japan may go all out in a do or die effort, actually risking national harakiri, is what he sends to Washington, D.C. And it gets there on November the 10th. And it says, you know, essentially, you know, they're a loose cannon right now. Anything could happen. So you might want to start preparing for something that can happen because negotiations aren't working. And that's exactly what's piling up here right now.
Grew's a very interesting and important character here, and as you quoted, Seth, I mean he's extremely insightful about the trajectory that Japan's going down. The problem we've always had with awarding straight A's to Grew is that his principal contacts among the Japanese are that swath of Japanese leadership that was happier in the 1920s than they are in the 1930s or 1941. So he has somewhat limited insights, or whatever. And he pressed extremely hard for this face-to-face meeting with Conoy in FDR, because he said, you know, this may be the last, in effect, this may be the last step to head off war. And then
right.
when you get down, as you quoted, so when you get down to November, he's being very clear. And he, one of the other cables, he says quite clearly, says, you know, if the Japanese go to war, don't expect an early warning from us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We are not in a position to be able to, you know, tell you.
That quote exactly is, as he says to DC, quote, armed conflict with the United States might come with dangerous and dramatic suddenness, unquote. So in other words, I can't let you know because I won't know.
Yeah,
exactly.
The bomb could blow up in your face.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, it's one thing, and I want to take a step back here for a second and just kind of look at the situation as it is right now, November 10th, 1941, because people are going to say
that's one of the problems here is saying now we're at, you know, September 10th, November 10th. I mean, there's so much that's going on.
There's
here.
A ton going
trying
on.
To boil down to an intelligible basis or whatever. But you have to understand that beyond what we're saying, there's all kinds of things back and forth or whatever here.
Oh, God,
we've tried to keep you on the straight line of
on
what
the
realities are.
Mm-hmm.
But want to set the record straight too, as far as United States reactions to Japanese efforts. And, you know, I see it all the time. People say the United States provoked Japan into the war. You know, they provoked. That's a bunch of malarkey. Because everything that the United States government had done to this stage was reactionary. It wasn't provocative. It was in a reaction, and wasn't a knee jerk either. It was a reaction to what Japan had done on their own. You know, we put the embargoes on them because they did this. We did that. We put the embargo in there because they went here. It wasn't, we weren't trying to provoke them into anything. We were trying to make them stop, for crying out loud, and realize, you know, what they were doing was wrong. I mean, I hate to put it in very childlike terms, but that's exactly what it was. Because I see it all the time that the U.S. tried, you know, we provoked Japan into attacking Pearl Harbor, and FDR knew, and that's a bunch of crap. It's a
And
bunch of crap.
And if you go to the Yushukan Museum in Tokyo, you will see exactly that interpretational line.
Yeah,
you know, that we, the Japanese, were the peacemakers. We were trying to stave off war. We were pushed into it by, you know, perfidious Albion and the sneaky Americans. And it's a whole thing.
The occupation of northern Indochina was a direct threat to China. Northern Indochina was a direct threat to China.
Yep.
The occupation of southern Indochina was a direct threat against the British, Dutch, and American interests in that region.
Yep.
So we were slapping them with these embargoes and sanctions and whatever you want to call them, because they were acting in an aggressive manner towards our friends, and we were trying to make them stop. So that whole notion of we backed them into a corner, that's not true at all.
Well, the other point that goes to this is those innocent Japanese just happen to be alliance partners of Nazi Germany. Does
Also
that
true.
tell you anything about these events or whatever here?
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing is, I guess I would just slightly modify things back to the other point. Clearly, you know, American public opinion, as we talked about previously, had switched dramatically.
Yes.
In favor of China, based on what they saw for those 4 years. And
mm-hmm.
FDR was basically holding the barricade on the oil embargo, because there were a whole series of steps, as I mentioned, and it was across the political divide, you know, at least to get the U.S. out of complicity with killing masses of Chinese. I mean, that was the bottom line on the whole thing. Not to get the U.S. into war, but to at least get us out of getting blood off our hands, trying to start getting some blood off our hands for what we were contributing to this horror that was going on in China. Now, the dividing point, though, does come in July of 41, when suddenly what's going on in China now is connected to what's going on in the Soviet Union.
Right.
And that's where we do switch policy, and we do make efforts designed to keep the Japanese from attacking the Soviet Union, not for us to attack. In fact, FDR, right down to the end, you know, he has, and in fact, famously, you know, even on December 7th, 1941, when he gives his speech, you know, he declares, we're going to go to war with Japan. He doesn't say anything about Nazi Germany, even though people are urging him to do that, you know, one step at a time. So
yeah.
it's, you know, I think that you're absolutely right. All these conspiracy theories, to me, the root of the whole thing is, again, it's looking at events only as if it's the US and Japan involved.
Right.
Right.
If you only look at that focus and only interpret things in that event and ignore what's going on in the rest of the globe, you're going to get it wrong.
There's a quote too. I don't, and I frankly don't. Yeah, Nomura wires Tokyo in November. And he says that the Americans would employ every economic weapon they possessed against Japan. And that for the sake of peace in the Pacific, the U.S. will not favor us at the sacrifice of China. So yeah. In other words, this goes back to the point that we were trying to make earlier, is that, or that we were making earlier, is that the Japanese or the United States, everything hinged on China. If the Japanese don't get out of China, you might as well walk out of the room because we're not going to continue this conversation here.
Yeah.
And the Japanese knew that. It was they were aware. You know. So, anywho, all right. So we're in the middle of November now.
Yeah.
Karusu gets into DC. He's Nomura's cleanup hitter, if you will. So he's coming in and
Minder.
What's that?
The minder. He's been said by Togo as the minder.
Right. Minder. Exactly. Minder. Exactly. So FDR actually considers briefly lifting the trade embargo for what is it? He says just a few months, if to basically foster the idea of negotiations with China. And of course, he brings this idea to Great Britain and the Chinese, and they both are like, no,
yeah,
no, this ain't gonna happen. But again, this goes to the whole idea of what you were saying, Rich, is that they're trying to, but the US is trying to buy time, but that we're actually are willing to work with the Japanese to a degree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the other larger point, although as we've indicated, the supreme issue is survival of the Soviet Union,
right,
and Japan's role in whether that's going to happen or not. But in any event, behind that is what FDR has steered by since 1937, which is enemy number one ultimately is Nazi Germany. Not yet. Mm-hmm. Germany is job one. If we can avoid also getting into war with Japan, that would be good. And we could concentrate everything on Nazi Germany or whatever here.
Mm-hmm.
And FDR is, of course, also steering by the fact that, Marshall and Stark, his chiefs of staff, told him, please, Mr. President, can you buy us some time?
Right. We are not ready.
We're not ready. So that's all going through FDR's mind. He's trying to process all these various demands and requirements or whatever here, while keeping in mind the supreme issues in front of them.
So let's talk about briefly, we touched on it, but let's get into it. Proposal B, Rich, from the Japanese to the United States. This is what Nomura hands in the proposal B. It offers, a withdrawal of Japanese forces from southern Indochina if the U.S. agrees to end aid to nationalist China, to Chiang, freeze military deployments in the south. The Japanese would freeze military deployments in the Southeast Asia area, except for their reinforcements of northern Indochina, which is, again, admittedly, they were to cut off supplies into China.
Right.
And then the United States would provide Japan with, quote, the required quantity of oil and assist Japan in acquiring materials from the Dutch East Indies. So we get this, and it's a no-go immediately, right?
Well, actually, when you read the way the terms are set, the terms are set so the U.S. and the U.K. have to do everything right now,
yeah,
according to this agreement. And everything the Japanese are required to do is manana,
contingent,
contingent, and phrased in such a fashion that the Japanese can come up with excuses for not doing various things. So, I mean, it's a completely one-sided agreement. But once again, I mean, the Japanese diplomats are channeling what they're being directed to do by the government, dominated by the militarists.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the war with China, so we can have that the Soviet Union. I mean, they're in a straitjacket.
Yeah.
So the U.S. actually had or considering a counterproposal to Proposal B, and then we get intel that the Japanese are moving even more people into southern Indochina, including ships full of troops. And we feel that the Japanese are not being sincere in their negotiations. And that whole idea of any kind of counterproposal to Proposal B is essentially moot. Now, Cordell Hull and FDR, like these guys are being, sideways.
Well, and what you're seeing here from a military standpoint is the buildup of what is going to be Yamashita's 25th Army. That 5th and 18th divisions are being amassed in southern Indochina. You're moving air groups down in there. I don't know if there Genzan and Mihoro air groups were there. Kanoya is going to show up relatively shortly. Those are the torpedo specialists who are going to be put there specifically as a counterweight against British capital ships. So yeah, we're detecting this fast-moving military buildup in preparation for what is going to be operations aimed at Southeast Asia by the Japanese.
Now, there's in the endless series of controversies over this, there's a little sub-issue about the fact that there's a one conspiracy theory is that these reports of the Japanese buildup and whatever that Stimson cites in his diary or talks about or whatever are bogus because the U.S. Army Intelligence Service is poo-pooing what's going on. Keep coming back to that. Now, the U.S. Army Intelligence Service, headed by one fellow named Sherman Miles, is about as wrong as consistently as humanly possible throughout this entire period. They reach their apogee of being wrong on one of the first couple of days of December when they submit an appreciation saying, "Well, as of this time, the only Axis power capable of offensive moves is Nazi Germany." So after 7 December 1941, when it appears that the appreciations of Sherman Miles and his colleagues have not been, shall we say, adequate, he's sent off to find further employment or whatever here. But it's interesting. I mean, I was flabbergasted that someone would start spinning this argument, citing U.S. Army appreciations over what Stimson was saying, because Stimson was acting as a better intelligence officer than his intelligence officer was or
Right.
whatever. Just
To an extent, I mean, a lot of this is also driven by the fact that if you look at the total staffing size of both Army and Navy intelligence at this point and code breaking operations in general, we've got like four people.
Oh,
It's literally measured in dozens. And, as again, fast forward 4 years, we're going to have 10,000 analysts breaking messages on a daily basis. It's insane, but we're nowhere near that at the end of 1941. We have skeleton staffs that are in many cases focused primarily on just doing the normal duty watch kind of stuff that's coming up. And there's also an emphasis at this point in time on our code breakers focusing on diplomatic traffic rather than trying to break military signals. So you're not getting a lot of the skinny on what the military might be thinking. So the Japanese military, I should say. Anyway, yeah, you're absolutely right that, yeah, trying to use any sort of prognostications from U.S. Army intelligence as being the smoking gun that says that there was nothing going on there. Yeah, that's ludicrous. Anyway.
Let's look at the end of November. Now we're looking at November the 26th, 1941, specifically. United
Nagumo's
States.
Kikita Butai has sailed this morning.
Yeah, they're gone. They're on the way. U.S. Intel, yet again, said that the Japanese were making a move towards Thailand. And we also knew that they had put a hard stop on negotiations on or around November the 29th. And this is when, to
The
that end,
28th
Cordell,
Japanese time.
say again, yeah, right.
It's 28th Japanese time, which basically is, like the 27th,
So
US time.
Cordell Hull then submits what history has called the Hull Note, which is essentially this is what we want you to do. The United States says, this is what we want you to do, Japan. And if you don't do this, then we're done. But Rich, tell us, break it down a little bit for us and what the Japanese, how they react to this, because I mean, we already know how they react to this, but.
Well, Hull was, he was, we talked about, over the couple of days before the Hull note, he'd been working diligently about trying to put together a response to the latest Japanese proposal and then consulting with the British and the Chinese, who obviously were not happy with what was going on. And then Ho learns that the Japanese have definitely established that the U.S. there has to be an agreement by what he first is told is 30th of November. Then he's told no, it's the 28th of November, Japanese time. And at that point, plus the evidence of Japanese troop movements, and Hull says, I mean, basically that's it. Diplomacy can't
It's over.
possibly deliver us from the situation we're in now. And what you have to understand when you read the whole note, the real background to that is like Munich or whatever here. And what Hull is trying to do is have the US, as it's just about on the cusp of war, to go out with the firmest possible affirmation of our principled stands over
Yeah.
China and everything else that's going on in the world. And it's, you know, clearly from the Japanese standpoint, it's like, you know, slap here, slap there, slap there. We're not going along with anything you want. I mean, that part
This
of
is
the literature.
this is intended for American consumption and allied consumption rather than Japanese consumption. This really isn't a negotiating position at
Not
all. It's
at all.
right.
So, and you know, to the degree that you know he comes down that way, you know, I will say that it leaves the U.S. in a much better position than the British and the French were after Munich.
So lay out the specific terms then.
Oh goodness!
There's
Well,
a load of them. I
there's a
got them
load
actually.
of them,
Yeah,
really.
I got them in front of me, and I'll run through them briefly. I won't go word for word. So there's two sections. The second section is the one that
The
carries the
kick.
most, kick to the balls. It's 10 points, and it goes, number one is multilateral non-aggression pact among the British, China, Chinese, Japan, the Netherlands, and the Soviet Union, as well as Thailand and the United States. In other words, we're not going to fight with each other. We're all going to be friends. Two, pledge. This is Japan must pledge itself to respect the territorial integrity of French Indochina. And again, we were reacting. The embargoes has be started because the Japanese moved into French Indochina. So in other words, get out. Number three, withdrawal of all military, naval, air, and police forces from China and from Indochina. Not going to happen. We already know this. Number four. Japan will not support militarily, politically, or economically any government or regime in China other than the national government of the Republic of China. John, this goes back to what you and I talked about in the episode we did, China 37 through 40, when the Japanese don't know, they no longer recognize Chiang's government as the official government. So you can't work with a government that you don't recognize as existing. Number five, both governments to give up all extraterritorial rights in China. So, in other words, get out of
The U.S.
Shanghai.
We're, yeah, we'll give up our rights in China if you will.
Yeah, which of course isn't going to happen either. Number six, enter into negotiations for the conclusion between the United States and Japan of a trade agreement based upon reciprocal most favored nation treatment. Which is, that's a lot of word salad to say, basically. You do what we want, and maybe we'll talk to you in a nice way. Number seven, remove the freezing restrictions on Japanese funds in the United States and on American funds in Japan. Number eight, agree upon a plan for the stabilization of the dollar to yen rate. Number
Oh, interesting.
nine, no, yeah, no, I didn't know that either until just now, until I read that. Number nine, no agreement with any third powers to conflict with the fundamental purpose of this agreement. In other words, keep the Krauts and the Italians out of this. Number 10, do not influence other governments to adhere to the basic political and economic principles in this agreement. So in other words, this is between you and I here.
I was just going to pop back to the withdrawal of forces here because one of the points that the Japanese harp on constantly with respect to China and the presence of Japanese forces within China is that they're trying to position them as we're here as peacekeepers, that there are, you know, there are all these bandits in the countryside, and you know, if we were to leave, there would be chaos that we'd be breaking out. So we're actually a force for good here. But yeah, to your point, that point, the withdrawal of Japanese forces from China, that's the real nub of the matter. And of course, the
Exactly.
Japanese are never going to go for that.
Never going to happen, man. Never going to happen. So, of course, as we know, Tojo sees this, and Rich, you said this in your book. Tojo sees this as an ultimatum. And of course, the United States, as we just said, this is, we're washing our hands of this event, and here we go down the road. So,
We also got verbiage with the note that says, that basically qualifies it that it's not an ultimatum. It says for discussion and things like that at the end of the note
right.
earlier. So technically speaking, if you were, a hardcore diplomat or diplomat's lawyer, you would say, no, that's not an ultimatum.
But Tojo, as we know, ain't.
Right.
So
Right.
when this is delivered on the 26th of November, it's handed to him. I mean, it's a no-go after that. Kido Butai has they've already sailed, right? Or did they sail
They
on the
sailed on November the 26th.
Yeah, they sail on the 26th. On December the 1st, Hirohito gives his approval for attacks against the United States, Great Britain, and the Dutch. So at this point, the die has been cast, and there's quite literally nothing that's going to stop the events going forward from here on out.
Yeah, it's all automatic at this point. I mean, obviously, Nagumo is operating under conditions of complete radio silence. Yes, he could have been recalled, but it's not like he's picking up the phone every night and asking, how are the negotiations going on? The other thing, of course, is that the diplomatic team within Washington, D.C., the Japanese diplomatic team, is completely in the dark as to what's happening from a military operational standpoint. Nomura is nobody's fool and understands that if he's been told that he has to have negotiations concluded by the 27th of November US time, that put two and two together, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that something bad may be happening, but they certainly don't know any of the specifics about what is going to go down.
Well,
And
of course, there's the line that says, after that drop dead date, things are going to automatically happen, which kind of tells you that, bad things are going to go down here pretty soon.
Just a couple of the points. One of the sort of classic counterfactuals that gets bandied about at this point in time is, why didn't the Japanese just focus on attacking just the Dutch or just the British and ignore the Americans as much as possible? Don't attack the Philippines. And there's two parts to the answer to that. The first is that there had been a series of war games that had happened in Japan immediately prior to the conflict where they war gamed some of those scenarios out and basically came to the conclusion that in any of those scenarios, if you go to war against one of these powers, you end up in a war against all three. And therefore, if you are going to go to war against the Dutch, that's really the nub of the matter. We need the oil. You may as well plan a campaign that is going to be multilateral and is going to go after all of those opponents. The second issue, of course, is that just the physical location of the Philippines is directly astride all of the supply lines they're going to have to be bringing this ill-gotten loot back up from the
It's a
southern
knife to
resource.
their throat right there.
Yep, that's exactly what it is. And no classically trained military mind is going to allow the Americans to hold that dagger to their throats. And so the Philippines have to be captured and taken out of the equation as an enemy bastion. And if you do that, you're automatically in a war with the US in any case. And so, given all of those, what do I want to say, stringencies, you're obligated to fight against the Americans. Now you should utilize your position of interior lines and better internal communications to pick and choose the time and place of your attacks. And that's why you end up with the shape of the campaign that the Japanese are going to come out with.
And then, of course, on top of all that, is they know that the Pacific Fleet is the biggest threat to
Right.
all of this. So
Right.
let's go knock that out at the forefront, and then we can
Correct.
do what the hell we want to do on our own. We don't have to
But
worry about these people.
this also plays into the problems with trying to sift the intelligence at this point in time. And it's absolutely true that if you go back after the war, and then we did this, the latter parts of the war, we ended up going through all of the signals and decrypting all of them. And yes, there were some smoking guns in there that, might have even pointed to a potential carrier attack against Hawaii. The problem for the Americans at this point in time is, again, we're completely understaffed. We're looking for the wrong things, and there are a lot of not even false positives. They're positive positives. We're like, yeah, it looks like they're going to attack in Malaya, or they could attack in the Philippines, or they could attack. they're attacking everywhere. That's all of that is true. So how do you pick out of that chaff, the little nuggets that might have pointed at Pearl Harbor, which we as Americans are over-focused on, instead of, looking at Pearl Harbor again as just one component in this much larger campaign. And I'm looking forward to getting into that in another episode.
Now the other, I guess, interesting counterfactual, if you look at what happens on the Eastern Front in December 1941, and the Germans falter and then they're counterattacked before
On
Moscow
this
and elsewhere, whatever.
5 December is
5
really the
December.
that's when
Exactly.
that all starts going
So,
down.
exactly. So, one counterfactual is, if the Japanese had waited even, 15 or 30 days, would it have been enough to deter them from going? I mean, obviously, we don't know the ultimate answer to that, but it would have taken a whole lot, I think. Once again, it gets back to the basic point. The Japanese, with good reason, think they've signed up on the winning side. And basically any static in the meantime is just, we just have to get over this and we'll be back on the path to ultimate victory.
My guess is that even if they had clear evidence that the Germans were being rolled back from the gates of Moscow, and understand that the Wehrmacht doesn't even understand this for really the better part of a week or so. Even as Hitler is making his deliberations around whether or not I should declare war on the US at this point, he still has no clear idea of whether or not we're seeing a series of local counterattacks around Moscow or whether this is, in fact, a large-scale counteroffensive.
Exactly.
I tend to believe that even if the Japanese had a clear notion of that, the imperative still remains. We have no oil. We have to go to war. So I don't think that that would have forestalled a Japanese attack.
I agree 100% because, as you said, they need the oil. The only way they're going to get the oil is if we is if the Japanese come out of Indochina and we pull people out of China proper, which was never going to happen. So the die was cast in 1940, frankly, when they moved into Indochina, and that and it's everything that happens after that is a result of those early actions, I think. Anyway, I feel. Okay. Well, my
There we go.
goodness. There
My
it is.
goodness.
There it is. Anything else you guys want to add to this one, or are we good?
Well, I think I always like to look at the upside, So the upside here is that if you really want to do a deep dive into totally fallacious statecraft and rampant idiocy and rampant lack of moral courage, you can turn to Imperial Japan in 1941 and you can teach everything you need to know about that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it really is a story of feckless leadership, if ever there was one. So,
Right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing, man. And neither of them can talk to each other. That's for God's honest truth. All right. Well, gentlemen, let's put a
Yes, sir.
bow on this bad boy. So, with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcast. Give us a rating and review, blah, blah, blah. Once again,
You're just so beaten down by now. You don't even do the whole spiel
I don't
anymore.
even
I
do
mean,
it
do you
anymore
remember
because.
when you were, a bright-eyed, optimistic beginning, YouTuber, and it's like, I'm gonna put my pitch in to please press the like and subscribe buttons, but
Because
now you're just like,
I know when people say, when they hear me say, and with that, they go, done. So they're not listening to any of this. Yeah, I could be sitting here doing a song and dance and talking about Bugs Bunny, and they'd never know. They'd never know. But you
Also,
watch.
my
This week they
feelings are
will, I
hurt,
guarantee.
Seth, that we aren't doing the full Monty or whatever.
That is also true. That is also true. So again, once again, I want to thank you. My name is Seth Perrin, and I want to thank you very much for listening and or watching this episode. John, my co-host, thank you for being here with us as always. And Rich, yet
Yeah.
again.
Banzai!
Banzai.
Banzai! Banzai!
Thank you very much for being here with us. And we'll probably see you again very soon, I'm sure. John, let's
Yep.
get out of here, man.
Thank you. And we'll see you all again next week.